Hi, this is Bruce Ryder, Five Finger Death Punch, and you're listening to the Jay Franzi Show.
Welcome to the Jay Franzi Show, a behind-the-curtain look at the entertainment industry with insights you can't pay for and stories you've never heard. Now, here's your host, Jay Franzi.
Well, hello, 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 and welcome to the show. I am Jay Franzi, and this is your backstage pass to the entertainment industry. This week, we get to talk with a producer, a songwriter, and an educator. And we get to talk with Dave Tough. We'll talk to him about how his time in LA shaped his career in Nashville, what it's like being a professor over at Belmont, and we'll discuss his battle with cancer and the survival of a heart transplant. Now, I have known Dave for some time. I've had a chance to work with him on several occasions, and I can't wait to talk with him tonight. So if you would like to join in, comment, or fire off any questions, please head over to jfranzi.com. Now, let's get started. Dave, sir, how
are you? Hey, doing well, man. I was just grooving out to your music. There's like Rival Sons meet something else, but nice, I was digging it, yeah.
I like stuff with a little bit of an edge.
Yeah, no, it's really cool. I was actually trying to think the way we first met. It was probably you when you were working with Bob Bullock.
Yeah.
Yeah. So mutual friend, amazing producer, engineer. Yeah.
Love Bob. Yeah. Great guy. Speaking of working for people, sir, I mean, you've worked for quite a bit of people yourself, right? So I mean, can you tell me what the time in LA, how that shaped your career?
Yeah. I mean, gosh, I think the first thing is taking a step back and just counting how many hats I've worn in this business, just because I feel like to survive in this business and to always keep a foot in the door, you have to wear a lot of hats. So when I was out in LA, well, let me take a step back. I got my degree in jazz drum set from the University of North Texas. It was a BA in music, but I studied jazz drum set and got out there and worked for Capitol Records for a year. Decided to move to LA. So I was kind of more on the business end. I was working for BMG. I was working for Warner Chappell, Warner Brothers. This was kind of on the cusp of the MP3 revolution. And they were kind of asking us youngsters, you know, what's going to happen, guys? And so I was actually more on the business side. I was getting my MBA out there. Got a scholarship out to Pepperdine to get my MBA. I kind of envisioned the music business as weird. Like, I kind of envisioned it still like it was in the 80s, you know, where it had some music about it. You know, you could actually be a musician and actually work in the business. But I quickly found out that wasn't the case. So the closest I ever got to really kind of being creative out in LA, LA was more business, but I had a home studio there on Bundy, made notorious by OJ Simpson, right? There on Bundy in a garage. And I did songwriter demos when I worked for Warner Chappell. So I did songwriter demos from a lot of great artists, and I still actually work with a few of those artists. One artist we're actually going to the studio this week, in Cindy Alter, who was like a famous star in South Africa. She was in a band called Clout, and I met her in LA, and just so many people that doing demos out there. But I did have a chance to work under Alan Sides a little bit. I don't know if anyone knows that name. Engineering nerds know that name, right? But, you know, founder of Ocean Way Studios and all that. I took a couple of his master classes and assisted there. And then Bruce Swedeen as well. So the way I got to meet Bruce Swedeen, and again, I don't know if your listeners know Bruce Swedeen, but Michael Jackson's engineer, really studied under Bill Putnam, kind of creating that whole legacy of the Bill Putnam legacy. And again, just all these names, go study them, but took that over from Bill. And of course, went on to do Michael Jackson and every other amazing artist under the sun. So I worked with Bruce when I worked at Cal Poly Pomona out there, and we did like a lot of master classes. It was called Cal Arts. Anyway, blah, blah, blah. So got to study some legends out there, but honestly, most of my time out there was kind of working in the industry. And then when I moved to Nashville, I was kind of like, okay, I'm going to hit this producing engineering thing full force.
All right. Well, you hit quite a few things in there I want to make sure we touch on.
Yeah, yeah.
One of them, you go to school for drums, jazz drums.
Right.
And then you end up working in the business side of it. How does one go from studying drums to end up actually working on the business side?
Well, you know, again, it's kind of like it takes a while, I think. And this is I just speak to any artist out there, anybody that's a creative doing a creative endeavor. It takes a while to find your voice. When I first started out, you know, I thought, hey, I'm a drummer. You know, I want to be Steve Gadd when I grow up. I always hear like songs in my head, and I always hear harmony in my head. And like when I was in undergrad, I started composing little, you know, jazz songs and stuff, learning MIDI. And I didn't know at the time, that's kind of like what a producer did, you know, but it's just, you do these things. And so, and then I was also playing other instruments in college. I was taking bass lessons as well. So number one, I kind of realized I guess I could have been a great jazz drummer if I really would have shed it. But I mean, I was pretty good, but, you know, I just kind of decided that wasn't quite for me to play in smoky bars and jazz and all that. So and this is another great music business story, just as the way things happen in the music business. I was hanging out at a bar there in Denton, Texas, and I just graduated. I met this girl at the bar, and she was really cool. We struggled with conversation, and she's like, oh, what's your major? What'd you graduate in? I said, music. She's like, oh, I work for Capitol Records in Dallas, and we're looking for someone for the front desk. You know, would you like to come, you know, check it out and maybe talk to someone and see if you're a right fit? And I guess I was cool enough to have her ask me. So, yeah, and that was a kind of a switch from, okay, now maybe I'm going to try this business thing out. But again, I was thinking of guys like Quincy Jones, that kind of thing where you could be a musician and in the business. But I kind of learned over the years, unfortunately, that there's not much music in the business part of it nowadays.
Right. You mentioned recording in a garage, right? So were you doing those demos at the time for the company?
Not directly for Warner Chappell, but I would meet artists as they came through the door at Warner Chappell. So I was working in copyright at Warner Chappell, but I was meeting a lot of artists, and then, you know, through the parties and all that, you know, just that whole LA scene. So I was trying to think of some of the artists like I was working with. Another band called Come and Go. I already mentioned Cindy Alter. Brandon Schott was another writer. Gosh, there's so many. Jake Simpson, who was on Star Search. He won Star Search twice. I don't know, just a bunch of talented people.
What was the setup in your studio in the garage?
I remember it was funny because this is when I first started engineering. So again, this was kind of the cusp of moving from ADATS to everything being in the box. So I had my copy of Cubase. I wasn't even on Pro Tools yet on the old Windows, whatever it was, 97. And I reached out to my buddy, Pete Matthews at Ardent. I had graduated high school with Pete. And I said, if I had to buy one piece for the studio, what would you recommend? And he said, get a Manly Vox box. So I saved up all this money, and it was great advice because, I mean, it's an awesome tube pre.
You still
got
have
a compressor.
It?
Yeah, Poltec type EQ. Do I still have that? No, I had to pawn it to you know how it goes. You know, you pawn things two or three times. So, but yeah, no, that was a great chain. And in fact, I kind of am still like, if I had one chain, and again, not getting too nerdy, but it would be a U87 through some type of tube pre. Like right now I have a 610, Universal Audio 610, and that comes from working with Bruce Swedeen, because he was a huge advocate, again, going back to Bill Putnam, with Universal Audio, of just that simple 610 chain, you know, the same basic preamp that the Beach Boys used to record Pet Sounds and all of that.
So what do you remember most during those days?
What do I remember? It's just, you know, it's crazy hustle, really. I mean, I just remember literally in LA, driving everywhere, meeting after meeting, driving my car from one place to another, making a lot of connections that I'll never regret making. But it was kind of just like, you know, life at fast forward. It was just living that lifestyle out there. And so I had the choice in 2004. My buddy had moved to Nashville. He said, hey, man, I think you might dig it out here. Like, it's not just country music. Because I was thinking, yeah, you know, I mean, I like Garth Brooks. But if I just had to do Garth Brooks projects or whatever, Trisha Yearwood, I probably wouldn't dig my life. But he's like, you know, it has some cool jazz and some other stuff here. I was like, okay, I'll come check it out. So that's 2004 is when I made the move.
Well, we talk about all the time how you have to wear multiple hats, and your career takes turn after turn based on what's presented in front of you, not by what you won't necessarily want to do.
Yeah.
So back in the LA days, what was your actual goal?
I'm still trying to figure that out, but just kind of, I mean, I guess you'd call it artist development, like, you know, meeting great artists, contributing what I can contribute, I'm not a great singer. I am a good songwriter. I am a good producer. I feel like I'm a good engineer. So, you know, just finding those synergies where I can find artists that I can help. And really, it kind of goes back. I tell my students all this to serving, right? Like finding the place where you can be of service to others. And, you know, essentially that's what I was doing. I don't know if I specifically knew that that was my goal, but I just wanted to be in the mix with talent.
So you're out in LA, you're mm-hmm. writing songs, you're working with artists. What's your actual process like?
So I'm just trying to think. I mean, obviously when you're working with someone, you need to identify really what their gifts are, you know, and then what you need to augment. Some people are better with melodies. Some people have a real character in their voice. Some people are good live performers, all of that. So just kind of deciding what's there and then maybe what needs to be augmented. And the great thing about, I feel like, you know, the joke is being a producer in Nashville is you just kind of sit back, hire great people and let it happen. But that really is what it is. I mean, you build a great team. You know, if someone is a artist and they play acoustic guitar, but they're not great at it, guess what? I can throw a rock and hire 50 amazing right. acoustic guitar players. Or if they're not, you know, great at promoting themselves, I can get someone with social media. So really, honestly, a lot of it is just knowing who to call. But I think for a producer or for an artist development person, number one, staying organized. Number two, maybe having the resources. And I guess that goes back to knowing who to call or knowing who to send people to. Also, you know, I guess writing the songs or finding the songs, if you're not writing with them, that will fit, number one, their persona and their brand. But number two, their vocal range, things like that. Because, you know, you've worked with artists like, yeah, I'll just throw out the name Kenny Chesney. We all know Kenny Chesney has like a 5-note range, right? maybe more like an octave, but it's not. So you're not going to give Kenny Chesney like a Celine Dion ballad, right? It's just not going to be the right fit. But you can give him something to show off the character of his voice, and you can give him show off something that shows off his culture and his brand. And that's really what we're trying to do for these artists. So,
well, you bring up some good points. Let's start with the songwriting piece. When sure. you're identifying a song, what do you feel makes a good song?
Wow. It's changed. I'm old school. I still believe you know, if it doesn't hold up on acoustic guitar or piano, acoustic guitar vocal, it's probably not something I want to deal with if it's just augmented by production and that's it. So I take the Bluebird Cafe approach. So that's one thing. You know, contrast, no matter if you're doing audio effects or songwriting, I always use the word contrast, right? Like take audio. If something has reverb on it, then other things don't need to have reverb on them. Same with songwriting. If something is in a high register, or one part of the song is a high register, the other part needs to be a low register. If something is very rhythmically busy, then another part needs to be rhythmically less busy.
When you're working with these artists,
yeah,
being a songwriter, how often do you try to work with the artist to craft the song versus pick a song?
Man, that's a great question because we live in Nashville, right? So if it's country, I will say I typically do a song search. Like I'm working with the artist right now, Cameron Ross, and he was on America's Got Talent. It's country. He likes kind of pop country. So like that, in that case, we did an outside song search and he found a couple of songs. But then he's also, I think he's a great example because he's also trying to break some rules. He's trying to do like reggaeton country and like dance country. So if I do a song search for that, there's not going to be much out there.
Right.
So in that case, we're writing, right? So like we're writing the songs for that part. But, you know, if it's just traditional straight up radio pop country, we're going to have a lot of great writers here in town to listen to at least.
So when you decide there's a song that you need to help and write.
Yeah.
What's the process there? Do you sit down with the artist and discuss it first or what's the.
Yeah, approach? I mean, we usually have a goal. Style would be one place. References, you know, like what references, but not only on the references, like, and when I say references, just for your audience to clarify, like, well, I like this song by this artist, this song by that artist, but what do you like about it? You know, do you like the melody? Do you like the lyrics? Do you like the production? So just getting them to define that. And then at that point, I know my strong suits are probably melody, rhythm, production. If they want something really lyrically intense, I have guys or gals that I can call that I would consider real strong lyricists to bring them in as a three-way co-write.
Nice.
Yeah. But, you know, I always want the artist's input if I can get it. So,
yeah, of course. So let's say you go ahead and you write the song. Mm-hmm. Do you personally try to accomplish writing all the songs before you hit the studio?
Gosh, you know, no, because I'm just going to keep using Cameron as an example because we are finishing up this project soon. He's like, it's more of a singles market. Like he'll release a single every 3 or 4 months. So, you know, release one, start another one. And I think the marketplace is more like that nowadays. Right. It's kind of just continual content. So there's really no deadline. We just kind of keep going. And the same is with, like, I do a lot of writing for Sync. So I just have a monthly, you know, slot on the books with several artists where we just write once a month or twice a month.
Yeah, there's no, in this market of, like you've mentioned, being a singles market, there might not be a deadline. But what I typically try to look at it as, still it's a business and you have to maximize the time that you, you know, and the money that you spend in the studio. Right.
I mean, that's the hardest thing, you know, with developing artists is just the budget and knowing where you can cut corners, where you can't. I mean, every time I would love to go hire A-list Nashville session guys, but sometimes that's not a reality. So, again, it kind of comes back to me knowing what I could do, which is a lot, you know, in the box nowadays. I can program the drums. I can play the bass. I can play acoustic guitar. But don't ask me to start playing lead guitar and all that. So, like, at that point, I'm going to go be smart enough to call up someone like John Willis or John Conley or one of my Johns and go, hey, guys, I need this. And those guys are cool, and they'll knock it out.
Well, you mentioned earlier working with the founder of Ocean Way, and now you find yourself in Nashville with Nashville Ocean Way. And there's a little bit of a connection there with your educational background.
Yeah.
So when you have the opportunity to go into a studio like that, do you choose Ocean Way?
Of course I do. No, I'm just kidding. It's Belmont, no. Yeah, I mean, there's lots of studios. There's certain things about Ocean Way Nashville I love, certain things that I honestly love tracking in smaller places. But yeah, I mean, shout out to Ocean Way Nashville. It's one of the few large format studios still in existence, really. Mike Locker is amazing, all that. You know, if I want a different drum sound, maybe a smaller room drum sound, I might go somewhere else. But
well, that's a good point. So what are some reasons for choosing a different style of studio?
Just drum sound, vibe. Sometimes I want to put everybody in one room, you know, with some baffles instead of a bunch of ISOs. Sometimes I don't want everybody to have a more me on their cues because I can sometimes with amateur players, that can cause more problems. Right. That it's worth because everybody's like, I'm just going to turn up me and turn down everyone else.
It takes a seasoned musician to truly be able to work a Momi box.
Yeah. And then I do a lot at home too. I built my basement out in 2019. I got a full drum set up here and a lot of rack gear and, you know, so can do some stuff here.
So you have basically the ability that you can truly track right there at your house.
Yeah. And the biggest thing, and this kind of goes back to your question of why not Ocean Way sometimes too, is everything here is set up and mic'd. It's kind of the Motown philosophy where I think that's part of the creative process sometimes is like if I'm writing a song and I have to sit down a guitar and I have to tune the whole guitar and just like, oh, none of this guitar needs a setup and just try to get over all the technical stuff, sometimes I lose that creative flow. So sometimes it's nice to show up somewhere where everything's patched in, all the levels are gotten. People can just literally sit down and create. And so there's something to be said for that.
Oh, absolutely. Now, going back to my days of teaching, and I'd like to get your opinion on it. You know, I always try to work with students to understand that gear matters, but it only matters to a certain extent.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, it's funny. Teaching audio engineering, I mean, I teach production and audio engineering and the line's blurred. And honestly, to me, the line is blurred between songwriting too. It's all a blurred line to me, but
especially these days.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, I honestly make the joke. I say like, what you're learning in here is 5% of the equation. You know, a good song, a good performance, a good artist is going to be 95% of the battle.
Oh yeah.
As they always say, great albums have been recorded on a Tascam with SM57s, right? So.
Nothing wrong with a 57.
Nothing.
Nothing wrong with it at all. You mentioned earlier work, our connection of Bob Bullock, and I had the opportunity to work with him for several years, and I really learned very quickly that it's not about the microphone. It's not about all of the gear. We used the best of the best, but it wasn't about that. It was about the talent sitting in the room.
Yep.
You know, it's more about the musician or the artist and what they're capable of doing, and then just capturing it when they're ready to do it. So it goes back to what you're saying with your drum kit and everything already mic'd. You're ready to capture a moment the second it hits you. You don't have to wait for that. And by the time you get it all set up, that moment's gone.
I mean, even same with co-writing. Like a lot of times I will give the people that I write with, will be sitting in that chair back there, and I'll give them an SM7. And that may be the final vocal we use.
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. So do you find it's more relaxing to work at home than it is in the bigger studios?
Yes, I do. The one thing I will say is at home, I still have to kind of mess with my gear, and I just don't have an assistant that knows my whole gear. So, and all my rack, if I did, that'd be nice. Then I could focus on just producing. So that's the one nice thing about going to somewhere like Ocean Way, you can get an assistant and then you can just focus on the music. So there's, I guess, good and bad, but I mean, here I'm still thinking about things. I'm still looking at levels and
right. Making sure you're not peeking over here.
Right.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. But I mean, you obviously, when you're in a more relaxed environment like that, you would think that you're able to get a more relaxed performance out of somebody, that they're not as quite as nervous.
Right, exactly.
Especially when dealing with a vocalist who might be a little less seasoned.
You know, but the funny thing is, and you know this because you work with artist development companies too, is like sometimes for the artist development companies, you know, they get off the bus and I'm going to be the next Taylor Swift or whatever it is.
Right.
They want to be impressed by going into the studio with, oh my gosh, look, it's amazing. And, you know, take pictures for Instagram and stuff. So there's something to be said for that too. Just the visual aspect. I mean, this is pretty, but it's not, again, Ocean Way with all the stained glass and all that.
Well,
so.
Yeah. Well, Ocean Way is just massive and it's beautiful. I mean, there's no doubt about it that it's a beautiful place and it's great for photo ops.
Yeah.
But it's a very expensive photo op.
You know, the other thing I always say is, and it's interesting that the studios left in Nashville are all subsidized by education, the large format studios.
Right.
You know, Sound Emporium now is Lipscomb, Belmont, Blackbird Academy, all that. So it's interesting.
Dude, what happened to Omni?
Oh, man. Condos.
It's crazy. Seriously. Isn't it?
And then, you know, the Pat's place that was Catty Corner for Omni, they're getting rid of that too.
That's insane too.
Yeah, I know.
We talked about Belmont and the studio at Ocean Way, and you're an educator as well, and you're a professor over at Belmont. So you mentioned you're teaching production and engineering.
Yeah.
So what's that like? What are those courses like these days?
And to some extent, songwriting, because I teach one class that is, it's called, you know, production for songwriters. So I kind of like teaching that class because we talk about arrangement. We talk about song structure, all that. We analyze hits. But yeah, typically, like I'm teaching that class, the Pro Tools for Songwriters. I'm also teaching some business for audio classes, you know, how to do your taxes and 1099s and all this stuff.
The exciting stuff.
Yeah, I like it. So I like that, legal considerations as a producer, you know, copyright stuff. I also teach, what do I teach? Master production, where it's like, you know, getting everybody in the room. And just again, like you said with Bob, leadership strategies, how to work with artists, that kind of thing. I've taught the grad classes. I just taught a master's in music for the master's in music students. So I don't know. I'm all over the map. I think that's one thing with me is like, I'm a generalist. I'm not the guy that's going to probably, you know, figure out the Doppler effect at 30,000 feet equation, but they throw me in the places where it's just kind of like, okay, you know, we need some general audio engineering production. And I don't know. I think my strength is that I kind of represent the modern, whatever you call it, songwriter, producer, engineer. But honestly, from a historic perspective, and I don't want to belabor this too much, when I look at guys like Beethoven or Mozart, they were, you know, producer, engineer, songwriters, because you think, well, if you said pizzicato and you said, we're going to put it in this concert hall, is that not engineering? I mean, is that not production?
Yeah.
So I don't know. I think it's been going on for a while. We're just kind of calling it one thing nowadays. So,
well, the reason why I even asked that is I know I'm old and I started back in the 80s. And when I started, people had their positions.
Right, right.
So you went and you became an assistant. You eventually became an engineer. And that's the way it worked. And you worked your way down the line, and then you might specialize in tracking or mixing or even mastering. Or you might just go into live sound. So everything had a direction. And it seems like these days, you are better off being a generalist and you're better off having a little bit of information about everything. But my question is the students themselves. Do you find that the students themselves are coming to the school and they want a more generalized education?
I know something that we do well with our students. Don't let me lose that question, because I if I'm not answering it, let me know. But I will say one thing I think we do good in our audio program, or do well, is they'll come in and say, I want to make beats. You know, they're freshman year. I want to make beats. Don't they all, right? So I want to make hip hop beats or just backing tracks or whatever. And I'll say, we'll just go up to the newest AI site and press one button. You'll have a beat. But joking aside, that really, we make them think larger. Like, there's so many jobs in the audio industry, not just, I want to make beats, right? So, like, we do a little bit of computer programming and show them there's a whole industry out there that designs plugins. Like you said, we make them do a sound reinforcement class. So, you know, there's all of that industry now, which I only see getting larger. Because of the AI thing, I think there's going to be a backlash for live, real music. Just a bunch of stuff. So they kind of open their eyes to there's other stuff out there. So I think we do a good job of that. In some ways, I think we flip the script. Like, we take people that think they want to do one thing and show them there's a whole world out there, and they get a taste of everything.
Yeah, well, I know when I came up, I wanted to work in the studio. I mean, that's why I chose to go to schools, because I wanted to learn the equipment that was in the studio. And then when I started teaching at the beginning, that's what it was like. It was students that wanted to be in a studio. And then as time went on, it seemed like it happened over a very short period of time, where it started to transition into beats, into you got a whole different type of student who came into the building and they wanted to learn things in a different way. And their idea of what producing is was much different than what the school had in the curriculum for what producing is.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess my question is, now with the new students, are they still working down that path? Do they still think of producing as creating beats? Do they even want to go into traditional studios anymore?
I think, again, we have to kind of educate them on that. We almost have to reverse engineer and make them appreciate the history. But I think, again, at Belmont, I'm just not bragging on us, but I am, that we do it really well because, okay, so you're in the box, you know, you're working in Pro Tools. You pull up an LA-2A compressor. If you've never really heard an LA-2A in real life, that's just a simulation, right?
Right.
Like, so I feel like we take them into a historic studio like Columbia, and we say, okay, here is an API that recorded, you know, one of the APIs we have recorded, like Frampton Comes Alive and all this. I mean, it is a straight up API where they got the 550 EQs from and all that. I mean, it's like a 70s API connected to a bunch of vintage outboard gear. And to me, number one, that gives them appreciation of the history. Number two, it gives them signal flow. But number three, they also hear what a real outboard processor sounds like, a real reverb chamber, a real, you know, whatever, tape machine. So now we'll go and we'll go in the flight simulator, which is Pro Tools, and with all the digital plugins that represent those, but hopefully they know what a real one sounds like. So then they can take that auditory memory and go into Pro Tools. So I think, you know, they are coming in probably more narrow-minded. I think at Belmont, and then we open their minds, but I like to think so. But also you have to also say that we're a 4-year institution. So we're doing that not only in audio, but we're kind of doing that in gen ed too. Like, they may come in with a very narrow political mindset, and then we come in and show them more things with general education. So it's not just the audio side. I feel like we open up things more in the whole degree.
Well, that's the benefit of being in a traditional university versus a dedicated tech college.
Right. And I did, when I did my doctoral dissertation, it was on audio education. And I went out and I asked, of course, this was almost 15 years ago, but I asked several industry professionals. We started with 50. It's called a Delphi study, and we narrowed it down. But we started with 50, like the Ivana Manleys, the Bruce Swedeens, all that. And we asked them, what does a college graduate need to know to be successful in audio? And this was in the future. I think I said 2019, but that's past, obviously. What do they need to know in 2019 to be successful? Well, what would you guess? What would you guess they said, like the skill sets that a person working in audio would need?
Well, just from my time in Nashville, the biggest thing they always said is you just had to have a good personality.
Exactly. So it was nothing to do with, like, the top 20 were nothing to do with the tech at all. They were all the soft skills, the people skills, ability to write, ability to communicate, ability to, like you said, work on a team. And so, like, and they kept reiterating, look, we can teach you how to patch. We can teach you a new console. We can teach you Pro Tools in, like, literally a month. We cannot teach you how to be a better human,
right?
You know? So that's where I think a four-year degree, not that it's going to make everyone a better human, but could make you more well-rounded in those areas.
Well, it really does. And while we talk about education, I mean, let's go ahead and go down that road for a minute.
Sure.
I think education is important. I always have. I mean, I'm educated. I've gone through, got my master's and all as well. But I don't think it's necessary. And just like you said, because especially in this industry, you can go in the field and somebody can teach you what buttons to press.
Right.
But like you mentioned, they can't teach you the personality part of it. That's just something that you have to have self-awareness and learn over time. You know, you go to school and you learn who you are. And then you also network. It's the networking that you get through the university, to me, that is the most valuable piece of an education.
I completely agree with you.
All right, then we can stop talking about that.
No, I mean, just even but like Belmont, and I think that's, again, one of our selling points is we're right on Music Row. People come from all over the world to be there. So you know someone's serious if they're your peer next to you. You know, they're pretty much there to be in the business. And so 20 years later, you look down Music Row, and it's the people you graduated with, right? You know?
Well, at Belmont, too, I mean, it is a true university. You're going on a campus and you're spending all of your time there. And it's not just going into a studio for a few months and then leaving. You're truly spending your time there and you're getting the general education in addition to the specialized education.
Yeah, and there are ways to work it. Like if you live in Tennessee, you can go to community college for 2 years and then transfer in. So, I mean, again, I'm not a proponent. I'm like you. You don't have to have it. And if you're going to graduate with $200,000 in debt, it's probably better not to have it.
Our industry.
Right, exactly. So.
That's too funny.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I know you've been there for quite a while now.
20 years, I think, come this fall, yeah.
There you go. Congratulations to you. So you're having the opportunity to touch a lot of students, and you're more like a mentor as well as an educator. So have any of your students gone on to do something that have made you proud?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've had amazing students. And, you know, it's like I'm just a very, very small piece of any of that piece. But no, maybe I got to think them to think of one thing when they were in my class, you know, that now they use. That's what the way I think about it. But and I always say, you know, I do a lot of film, TV, music. I produce a lot of bands, but I would much rather affect, you know, 200 lives a year than really deeply affect than have 200,000 people watch my show or my song on a TV show and didn't forget about it.
10 minutes later.
You know, 10 minutes later. So, yeah, I mean, gosh, it's a lot of songwriters. Emily Wiseband, Ryan Hurd, Claire Dunn. Gosh, I'm probably forgetting so many. And a lot of these names, Ian Munsick, he's getting big now. Gosh, I mean, honestly, I'm probably forgetting half of them that I've had in my classes, but I'm just surprised all the time where I'm like, oh, they were in my class, you know?
Do you see that transition over that four-year period?
You see a little bit of it. And honestly, it takes a few more years after they graduate. So it's like, they're not quite ready. A lot of times, like in my class, I specifically give an assignment where I collaborate with the students. They top line some of my tracks. And even at that stage, they're not quite ready, but it's usually like 3, 4, 5 years later down the road, you go, okay, it takes time. You know, it really takes time to develop your artistic voice, to find yourself, all of that.
You mentioned TV shows and movies, and
yeah,
it's a great way to make money in our world. But one of the credits you have to your name is a movie that kind of touches me, and that's Observe and Report.
Oh my gosh, man. That really touches you. I love it.
Only
like
because of the world of security. So can you tell us how that came about?
That was one of my first major motion picture placements. And it's not like an incredible placement. It's actually in like this restaurant scene, and they play the song for 3 minutes. It's a country song. But what it showed me is, well, number one, that's kind of like what got me into, that's one of the things that got me into doing sync a lot more, because I was producing a lot of demos here in town, whatever you could call them, demos, masters. I mean, at a certain level, a demo becomes a master. And they were just sitting on the shelf because, again, I wasn't someone's cousin to get on their publishing company or whatever, get that production deal. And so I started shopping these demos to some of my contacts in LA. Great company I've worked with for several years. Shout out to Tanvi at Crucial Music. But she was the one that got us the placement for that. So it's like this song, and it contributed to the emotional aspect of the scene, and it lasted 3 minutes. And then I looked at my BMI statement. BMI statement, and I go, oh, that's pretty nice. Still has 3 minutes in a major motion picture, because then you start to see the royalties come from all over the world. You see it when it's in the theater. Then you see it when it's in the U.S. Then you see it when it goes to other countries. It's like this dwindling, you know, HBO, then the next one, FX, and then TBS. It kind of goes down the network tier, and now it's streaming, and you're still seeing, you know, stuff on the royalty statement. So what I tell my kids is like, yeah, you can go down to Broadway and pay and play a gig for $200, or you can write a song and get $200 a week for the rest of your life using that same 3 hours.
Right.
So.
Well, you say that. That's a good point. I mean, I've written several songs at this point, and I've had a little bit of success.
Yeah, I want to hear these songs, Jay. Yeah. When do I get to hear these Air Supply songs? Yeah, I heard about
telling
them.
Telling you, dude. It's pretty sad.
I really do want to hear them.
So. But I wrote one that was in Saturday Night Live.
Oh, cool.
And like yourself, you know, it was in the scene for a good bit of time. And that was probably the best payday I had in the business.
Yeah.
I was lucky enough. Saturday Night Live's recorded for an hour and a half, and then they cut it down to an hour for the reruns. And my song made the cut for the hour. So when it reran in all the different countries, awesome. I got to still see the check come in.
And they still have like an SNL channel on Roku. So like my wife and I watch that all the time. So you're probably still getting royalties from that.
You know, it's a nice thing.
It's not just one placement, though. I think, you know, it's like a misnomer to make people hopeful. Oh, I get one placement. It's probably, I mean, if you really want to make a living at it, you know, it's several, probably hundreds of placements.
Of placements.
That add up to like, okay, this is a decent living, but you just kind of chug along and you get a few a year and hopefully it adds up.
Well, you've had some success with it. I mean, the other one I wanted to ask you about was the TV show Nashville.
Yeah, actually I think I've had 3 placements on Nashville through the years. And again, just it's kind of coming from like making good demos. Like, hey, this sounds like country radio, but it's not country radio. And let's put it on a TV show because we can afford the master. So one was with the band called Daydream Catapult. I think that was one placement I got. And then I wrote the song, when I first moved to town, called Hillbilly Hollywood. And it was about Nashville. Of course, it's gone like extreme now, but it was kind of about the whole dichotomy of, you know, the LA of the South. Of course, it's kind of self-fulfilling prophecy. But I think that's also got on Nashville. But a lot of it's just production quality and then having kind of universal lyrics, where it's not getting in the way of the scene, you know?
Where do you see the future of all this going?
As far as sync, I think it's a good place to be because you look at what people pay for. Yeah, they're paying $10 for Apple TV. They're paying whatever, $12 for Netflix. I don't even know where it's at now. They're paying for Disney Plus. They're shelling out all these bucks, but how much are they paying for Spotify? Maybe if you're lucky, like, you know, half of those people are maybe paying for a Spotify or Apple Music subscription. So you know where the money is. And so if you can attach to those things, it's great. AI, obviously, is going to affect it a little bit. I see it affecting things like soundscapes, ambient beds, special effects first. Then maybe next is like, oh, here's a generic, again, trap beat. Another reason probably we want to get away from making beats.
Right.
EDM, whatever. I think it's going to be a long while before AI is going to do acoustic music with like a great voice, all that. Maybe in 20 years, I'm worried, but there's been a whole shift too. And I think it's smart in the industry. And there's a shift I've kind of dealt with in the last 2 years of being song focused to artist focused. So now the sync business is more like the record business is, meaning it's really all about the artist and their voice and not about just the song. I don't know if that makes sense, but they want an artist attached if it's a bigger placement.
That would make sense, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So when we talk about that, I mean, we talk about development, and these days when you're talking to your students or anybody else looking to break into the industry, how do you feel that they should start to market themselves?
Man, if I always say if I had the answer to that, I would be a millionaire, because what I do is I make the widget, right? And then it's kind of like after I make the widget, I know it's a commercially viable widget, but after that, it's kind of a world I don't want to live in. And I put my head in the sand, like the whole let's get on and show myself eating a sandwich on Instagram. But honestly, that's what it is. You know, posting regular social content, developing your fan base, developing your brand, all of that. And that's something I need to get better at even as a producer. Just, I wish I had that game on lock. So if that's what you do, you know, and you're cheap, shout me out. So, you know, I mean, I just don't know that.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. Do you think that's important for those who work behind the scenes?
Well, you know, the thing is like, for me, I want to wake up. So I'm a heart transplant survivor. It's part of my story. And I want to wake up every day doing what I love to do. And if I have to wake up and I have to do 2 hours of social media garbage before I even am creative, that's not a day I enjoy. Right. So that almost answers your question, right?
Well, it might not be what you enjoy, but do you feel like it's necessary?
Okay. That's a different question. I mean, that's something I'm struggling with, honestly, right now in my business life. I mean, I'm doing pretty well and I'm wearing a lot of hats, but do I want to take it to the next level? Do I want to take it to that, you know, like, you know, larger producer level? And to do that, I would have to do something like that. So I think it is necessary in some aspects to get to the next level.
No, absolutely.
But I like my life right now. I like if I could just sit in this room, write songs, and write with people I love to write with.
Right.
Like, okay, awesome.
I was going to mention challenges, but you mentioned being a heart transplant survivor. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Oh, my gosh. Well, yeah, it was kind of a sudden thing. I went through a divorce in 2016 and, you know, attorneys and all that, child custody and all that. And I never had any heart issues, but I did go through cancer treatment when I was 32. So that probably didn't help matters. But I think the stress of all that kind of sent me over the edge. So when I was 40, I went in the hospital short of breath and they said, you have the heart of an 80-year-old. So I said, oh, interesting. Okay. So they tried to treat it medically, but ultimately they treated it with a heart transplant. And it's a whole God story. It's kind of my testimony, but basically the timing worked out where I got a heart. I wasn't supposed to get a heart and all that. And here I am, what, 7 years later. So it's just again, kind of any of us could walk out and get hit by a car any day. But I think a lot of people in our society or just in the world in general ignore that fact of life. And I'm kind of hit with it every day because I take a heap load of medicines every day and I go, okay, I'm going to enjoy this day. So,
well, I'm curious about it. I mean, I've had my mother actually had a double lung transplant.
Oh, wow. Wow. And
I know that was a very hard time for her, and we had to wait an awful long time on a transplant list. And even then, they didn't want to give her the transplant because they thought she was too old and they thought she was too short. Apparently, she was an old Italian woman and being short, and they didn't think a normal size adult's lungs would fit into her body. And she ended up getting the lungs of a teenager.
Wow. So
it was a tough thing, but how long did you have to wait on the transplant list to get the heart?
So you're right. They do match frame. They match height. They match blood type. And then you can tell them, do you want a high risk organ? You know, someone that was a drug user, all that. So I was on the list for a month and then I had made the decision. It was kind of like sitting in the hospital room, connected to all these tubes. And I said, I got to live life. So I made the decision to get a heart pump. So I was going to get the heart pump. There's a whole nother thing that goes along with that, like having to charge batteries every 4 hours and you got to be basically tethered down. There's a lot of restrictions. And, you know, the pump could die. I mean, it's scary.
My father-in-law has that right now.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know that. And so I got an infection in my blood that pushed back that surgery 2 days. And the night before that surgery was supposed to happen, I got a call for a heart. So to answer your question, it was about a month. So I'm blessed. Yeah.
Do you know where the heart came from?
I think it was up in your neck of the woods. I think it was Kentucky-ish. I'd never really tracked down the donor. To me, it's just, I don't know. Right now, I'm not quite ready to do that. There's some emotional stuff that comes with that, right, too, you know.
That's why I was asking if you knew any of the stats of the donor themselves.
I mean, I know it was a young male, so.
Yeah. It's hard, right? I mean,
it's
a good day for you and not for somebody else. So it's never an easy thing.
Yeah.
So do you know anything else about what life is like from after the surgery to now and for the future?
As far as expectancy
how many pills do you have to take?
I mean, the average they say is 10 years after getting the heart. I've had mine for 7, but that's statistics, you know, that's old, young, sick, not sick. There's people on the Vanderbilt list, and Vanderbilt's number one in transplants, by the way, here in Nashville and the world. I think they do like 170 odd transplants a year. So there's people that have lasted 40 years. There's one person that just lasted 40 years with heart. So
how many pills and stuff do you have to take?
I'd say at least 20 a day, like maybe 10 in the morning, 10 at night. The hardest thing is like the low immunity thing. So, you know, your immune system's going to be low the rest of your life. So you just have to really, really be aware of that. So like times like COVID, and that's kind of why we had that conversation in society, which was a really hard. I mean, I understand both sides of it. You know, I mean, I understand like personal freedom, but then also for people like me, it's like, well, we're very susceptible, older people. So I had to basically stay inside. But you know what? Hey, I picked the right career, right? I'm in a dark room away from people. So
do you still think about that now? Do you still take any precautions based on what happened with COVID?
Yeah, I mean, I wear a mask in crowded environments. But I think it's in some ways like COVID standardized that, or it made it more socially acceptable. Well, they always have done it in Asia, right? Like you see anybody, but here it's like, okay, there's someone with a mask. It's not, they're not scary anymore. But yeah, I need like high traffic situations, but it's hard being a teacher because I also want to communicate with my students, you know, like, so a lot of times during the winter months, I'll wear a mask, but I'll pull it down. And then they come up to me to hand me a paper or something. I have to put it back on. It's just, it's not going to be perfect. You know, it's never going to be perfect. You just have to be more aware of it.
All right. Let's get back into our world of music. So you're producing all this music, you're educating, you've got quite the wide range of hats that you wear, but you also play in bands. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. So, again, like I kind of told you my background, I drums was my first instrument. Then I started playing bass. The thing I liked about bass was that it was the bridge between the harmony and the rhythm. I always felt the rhythm as a drummer, but I heard harmony in my head. I don't know how to explain it, but it's not like you can sit there and go, oh, this is like, you know, a major seventh chord, boom, 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 you know, and like, no. So at least I like the bass because of that. I mean, I play piano, I play a little bit of guitar, all that. So anyway, when I moved to Nashville, some good advice I got was do something that's not Nashville, right? Like you're going to work more, you know, so like start a Latin band or start a big band or something. So believe it or not, 20 years ago in Nashville, there wasn't an 80s band. So when I first moved to here, we started an 80s band, probably remember it.
Bueller.
So we played at the Flying Saucer every Thursday night.
Yep, I remember that.
4 years. And that made us really tight as a band. And so, like, we were playing some off-the-wall stuff. Now, it's so funny because I swear, you know, they just stole our set list because, like, you go down Broadway and everybody's playing Your Love and everybody's doing that, you know, all the songs we used to do. But they weren't doing them back then. So we were doing all that. And so that band, I still book that band for corporate and wedding stuff. So, you know, we could be working more. But honestly, I kind of like to work twice a month, you know. That's fine with me. Get out of the house, pay the bills, go play, have fun with the guys and come home. And then there's another offshoot of that band, called Party of Five, which is more kind of modern. Cause these brides aren't, you know, getting older, they're getting younger. So it's like, are they going to remember the 80s music? So Party of Five, we kind of do like 90s and then more modern top 40 Bruno Mars and all that.
Is
so
it the same band?
It's the core, same core rhythm section. So different female singer, sometimes different guitarist, but it's just younger material basically. But anyway, I like to get out of the house and do that. It's cool. Again, I see only more work in the live field. The problem is, you know, I'm getting a little older, so I don't want to lug all my gear all the time, but in the PA and all that. But yeah, I see more action in the live field, honestly, with the AI on the horizon. So
yeah, I can see that as well. Looking back at your career, going through all those years with the band, going through the 20 years of being an educator, working in the production, what's been your favorite moment?
Oh man, that's a great question. I'm gonna have to say, not music related, honestly, having my son, getting married to my wife, my current wife, Michelle, shout out, it makes my life awesome. And then probably professionally getting my doctorate.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because that, you know, it's like this side thing that I always have. It's weird. You know, I wear a lot of hats. You understand it. You're a creative and you have your master's degree, but it's like it's another side path. And, you know, just to climb that mountain and to get that done, it's quantifiable. I mean, I could say, yeah, this song and this commercial or whatever, but to me, that's so short lasting. I, you know, honestly, another answer would be educating 5,000 students. I probably had that many students come through my doors for 20 years. Cause even before I was at Belmont, I was at University of North Alabama and then UCLA, Cal Poly, all that. So, but that's harder to quantify, but just saying like touching all these lives. So
that's pretty cool. You mentioned the doctorate and I'm kind of curious about that. First of all, where'd you get it from?
I wanted to work in the music business. So I had the music undergrad. I got my MBA at Pepperdine. I kind of told you that my dreams were shattered when I realized that the music business wasn't about music. So when I moved back to, well, not back, but when I moved to Nashville, there's really not a degree in recording or a doctorate in recording. Like who's going to get a doctorate in recording here in the States? You can go to Canada, you can go to McGill and get the Tonemeister doctorate. So, you know, what I did was I kind of tailored a doctorate program to myself. I went to Tennessee State here in town and kind of made my own program. I was taking education classes, but all the writings I was doing in my thesis and my dissertation was on recording education. So I just took the education theories and then applied it to recording. So it's in education. It's an EDD.
How long was the program?
Well, I mean, I was going nights and weekends for like 5 to 6 years. So I don't even know. Probably 2 or 3 if you went full time.
Yeah, see, the reason I ask is I've considered it, but as soon as I see 5 years, I'm like, yeah, never mind.
Yeah, and the only reason, the impetus, and I think you may have to be in an academic situation because the impetus for me was that you couldn't reach tenure, at least like most universities, especially Belmont, until you had that doctorate. And I wanted the tenure because, hey, guess what? Right now I'm on sabbatical. So like I'm off 6 months. Now I still have to do a project and all that, but I'm off 6 months right now. And I get to do that every 6 years. So stuff like that, that's really cool with getting full professor and tenure. You just couldn't do without a doctorate. So
that's awesome. Yeah. I have no actual reason to get a doctorate.
Yeah.
Other than just wanting to do it, but it's tough at my age at this point, that many years, it's like, yeah, the ROI is not there.
Right. Exactly. It's yeah.
So
yeah.
All right, sir. Well, we do this thing here we call Unsung Heroes where we take a moment to shine the light on somebody who works behind the scenes or somebody who may have helped you along the way. Do you have anybody you would like to shine a little light on?
We already talked about my wife and my family, but I think I'm going to shout out my parents this time because I don't shout them out too much. So both my mom and my dad, you know, like obviously I wouldn't be where I was if I didn't have my parents, but just the continuous support that they gave me, both in my education and just always encouraging me to do what I loved. You know, my dad basically told me when I first started out, pick something that you love to do, you know, never work a day in your life. And my mom was always there being very encouraging. So I would say my parents.
A big thanks to Dave for taking the time to share his stories with us. And thank you for taking the time to hang with me here. As always, I really do appreciate it. If you know another music fan that would enjoy this episode, please be sure to pass it along. You can do just that and find the links to everything mentioned over at jfranzi.com/episode64. Thanks again for listening, and I'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to The Jay Franzi Show. make sure you visit us at jfranzi.com. Follow, connect, and say hello. This episode has been brought to you by VR Knives, your source for 100% custom knives made by a true rock star. So, if you're in the market for a new piece of art, reach out to VR Knives. 407-421-5528. 407-421-5528.